This is the first session of the teaching day on the Book of Hosea, done by the London International Church of Christ. This session is on Hosea's life and times, the political, spiritual situation in which he found himself and during which he was prophesying.
All right, the handout does give you the geography of what we're doing today in the Book of Hosea. It is our teaching day, and I'm very appreciative of you coming today. It's great to see so many biblical scholars. And in honor of the fact that you're exceptional biblical scholars, we will, of course, be conducting today's teaching day entirely in Hebrew. Okay, maybe not. The Book of Hosea. What are we doing today on the Book of Hosea? Let me talk through today's plans. We will be having a break in between the sessions. First of all, we're going to be talking about Hosea's times, the time in which he lived, prophesied, and wrote his book. We'll then, in the next session, be talking about Hosea the prophet, as a prophet and as a man, and his life. And then the third session, before we finish, we'll be talking about the major themes of Hosea, and I think some of the particular relevance of those themes for us in the 21st century, in London, here in this church. The major sections of the book of Hosea are two. Hosea's chapter 1 to 3 are essentially God's call on and to Hosea. Chapters 4 to 14 are God's appeal to Israel. Chapter 14 is a final appeal and addresses the reader, but we'll come to that later. I have been asked, why have a teaching day on the book of Hosea? There are so many good books in the Bible. Why particularly this one? Well, I would perhaps want to share with you, if you like, my own motivation why I studied Hosea, because earlier this year, I made Hosea the focus of my own Bible study for some considerable time. And I had my own reasons. I think the book of Hosea is so helpful because it talks a lot about grace and about love and about unconditional love and about loving when it's difficult to love. I think for many of us over the last few years, we've had to recover our sense of love for people, our sense of love for the movement of God, our sense of love for the local ministry as well as perhaps broader, a love for people and the mission. We've tried to recapture the heart of love, and I think we've needed that, a love for God and a love for others. I also, as many of you will know, I love my kids. This is Lydia and Fred, taken a couple of years ago. They're wonderful kids, but as most of you will know, they're not yet disciples. They are now 22 and 21, almost 21 years old. It's a difficult thing for me and my wife, as I've shared in many places before, to give our kids as much love as they need us to give them and as is right to give them at the same time as they haven't yet shared with my wife and I some of the deepest thing in our hearts and lives, which is to be united with Jesus Christ. They've not joined us in that, and so it's difficult to love somebody when they don't love what you love. Does that make sense? And so in my own struggles and pain with this from a wife and I found the book of Hosea to be tremendously helpful. And as I've been struggling with just loving my own children unconditionally, not just as much as the world might want us, you know, it might be right to love them, I really struggled with this. And I had a conversation with Chris and Kim Reed back in January this year. And they have some struggles with their own children's situations, as some of you will know. And we have some similarities and some things in common with our family life. And so we sat down and we talked over things with them and asked them what had helped them in their faith and so on to handle all this. And they recommended a few things, including this particular book called Redeeming Love by Francine Rivers. How many of you have read that book? Just about to start it. Some of us have read it. When you do start it, you won't be able to put it down, I'll tell you that. It is the most extraordinary book. Francine Rivers has written a number of books on Christian themes and using characters from the Bible. Many of you may have read her books. This is a novelization, essentially, of the story of Hosea. It's putting Hosea into the gold rush, the Californian, I think, gold rush of the 1800s. And it's a story of him and a woman in his life. And it's not exactly the book of Hosea, but it has the same themes, and it's very, very powerful. And I read that, and it had a very profound impact upon me. And realizing that it was a novelization of Hosea in the Bible, it sent me back to the book of Hosea, making me want to read it and study it. And as I went back to it, I can tell you that studying the book of Hosea has profoundly changed my faith, profoundly changed my life, profoundly changed my heart. And I pray that as a church in London, as we study this, it will change us too. Let me tell you some of the resources that I used in preparing this teaching day, but also in my own Bible study. I used a number of commentaries, the IVP Old Testament commentary and the IVP New Bible commentary, and also a book from a series called Interpretation on the book of Hosea. Is also the Minor Prophets by a fellow called James Lindbergh, John Knox Press. And the one that I found the most helpful and enjoyed most was Bible Speaks Today series, The Message of Hosea, written by Derek Kidner. I really like Derek Kidner as a writer and a writer of commentaries. If you see any commentaries by that chap, then they're well worth buying. He has a particular speciality in Genesis and the Old Testament as a whole. And I really enjoyed using those resources. So before we go into some of the detail of Hosea's background, let's actually open the book and read chapter 1 together. Hosea chapter 1 and verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea son of Beeri during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to Hosea, "Call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day, I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel." Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, "Call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel, that I should at all forgive them. Yet I will show love to the house of Judah, and I will save them, not by bow, sword, or battle, or by horses and horsemen, but by the Lord their God." After she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, "Call him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' they will be called sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, 'My people,' and of your sisters, 'My loved one.'" Chapter 1, creeping into chapter 2 there at the end of the chapter, sets the tone and sets the scene for the whole of the book of Hosea. And I don't know about you, but when you read that, is there a more shocking first chapter of any book in the Bible? Go and marry someone who either is a prostitute or is already promiscuous or will become so. It's not entirely clear. It's pretty intense. So, what are the reasons for studying Hosea as we look at such an extraordinary passage like this? First of all, we're going to learn a great deal about grace in the Old Testament. Isn't that a good thing? There's a lie abroad, which is that in religious circles in particular, but I think sometimes even disciples tend to believe it, which is that in the New Testament, grace abounds. It's everywhere. It's awesome. In the Old Testament, there is no grace. Indeed, there is so much grace in the Old Testament, and we're going to learn more about it. I think the book of Hosea demonstrates this and teaches this more than any other Old Testament book. One commentator said the story of Hosea is second only to the gospel. If you want to take books of the Bible, many people feel that the book of Hosea is the nearest to the gospels of any book of the Old Testament, that there is more about the love of God, the grace of God in the book of Hosea than any other Old Testament book. It's an anticipation of the Christ story in many ways as we talk about redemption and unconditional love. I believe we need to understand the God of the Old Testament if we're going to understand Jesus. If we don't understand the God of the Old Testament, we will not fully understand Jesus, the apostles, the context in which they lived, and much of the message that they taught. The book of Hosea can reveal a great deal about the heart of God. God is a God of grace in the Old Testament. If we grasp this, it will make a massive difference of our reading of the Old Testament, our understanding of God's work, and our relationship with God. The whole book of Hosea is about relationships. It's about marriage. It's about children. It's about God and the people of Israel. The whole book of Israel is focused on relationship. And let's face it, the whole Bible is focused on relationship. The whole of what we're here about is about relationship with one another, those who are in the darkness, and with our great and mighty God. We're going to learn a lot as we study, not just today, but I pray in the weeks to come, a lot about the grace of God in the Old Testament. Also, we'll be learning a lot about the heart of God, which, of course, is connected with what I just said. And I think in particular, what the book of Hosea helps us with is to help us to understand that God understands what it feels like to be betrayed. And betrayal is one of those things in human life that is one of the hardest things to deal with. The deprivations we sometimes find in financial difficulties or sickness, and all they're difficult. But I don't know if there's anything as wounding, as deeply wounding, as the sense of betrayal. And many of us have faced and experienced, or perhaps even still are suffering from, betrayal that we had in our family life growing up. Betrayal of trust, betrayal of things like our parents being divorced or other things that happen like that. There's a deep sense of betrayal. Sometimes it happens at work when you think you can trust someone you work for or work with, and then they're backstabbing you, and there's the slander and the gossip, or your boss is doing something different from what he said or she said. And we experience a lot of betrayal in our work situations. We experience betrayal sometimes with friends. I do remember a time, which I haven't got time to share about with you, but when I was a student, and my best friend stole my girlfriend from me. Yes. Now, he actually did me a favor because if that hadn't happened, I might never have met Penny, you see. So it turned out good in the end. Amen to that. But I remember the sense of betrayal of turning up at a party thinking that my girlfriend wasn't able to come, and walking into the party, and then 10 minutes later he walked into the party holding hands with my girlfriend. Betrayal. And let's face it, my friends, sometimes even we feel betrayed, even here, in our relationships in church. It happens. How do we handle it? How do we handle it when someone that we loved, we studied the Bible with, and got baptized, then leaves the fellowship? Perhaps not only leaves the fellowship, but leaves us as a friend. And you invested so much time, so much love in that person. It's tough, isn't it? Haven't all of us experienced that? How do we handle it? Do we just block it out and say, well, it doesn't matter. Oh, well, it happens, you know, it's just one of those things. I don't believe that's how Jesus felt about Judas. I don't think it's how he felt about Peter when he betrayed him. I don't think that's how God feels. He doesn't block it out. He experiences the full pain of betrayal. And the book of Hosea shows us how God feels about it, how God deals with it. And I believe it could help many of us with healing, where we still are in great pain and perhaps have not been able to resolve the pain of having been betrayed. So I pray that this book will help you as much as it has helped me in this kind of area. Here's a quote from one of the commentaries. Amos, the prophet Amos, dwells on what God has done. Hosea dwells on what God has felt for Israel. God feels things deeply. This is important for many of us who don't connect with God on an emotional level, particularly, who see God's love as something he has to do, rather than something that connects us with him on an emotional, spiritual, emotional level. God cares. He is compassionate. He is jealous for his relationship with us. We will see much of this in the book of Hosea. We see passion and commitment. It's an interesting thing that in the world today, when you talk about passion, I don't know about you, but I think in general terms, when we think about passion in a marriage context or relationship context, let's talk about between men and women, the Hollywood idea of that is a rush of emotion and hormones leading to very quickly to sexual activity. And that's where passion goes. Isn't that right? That's what we see. And sometimes I think it's hard to redefine that in terms of, yes, passion is great and awesome and good, but it goes together with commitment. And what we see in the book of Hosea, what we see, I believe we'll learn a lot about, is how passion and commitment go together. Love is not just practical. Love is passionate. God is passionate. And the book shows us this more than any other book of the Bible. We need to understand that passion is not just unrestrained feelings. Passion and commitment go together, and that is what the book teaches us. As this chap Kidner says from one of the commentaries, he says, there is hurt, humiliation, waiting, personal approach and appeal, and last, mutual commitment. Cost, too, but mostly the cost of risking rebuff, reopening wounds, working at a difficult relationship, and being determined that it will last and grow. That's such a description of normal human relationships. But it's a description of God's relationship with Israel. The story is about love. It's not about power. The story is also about a radical call. We looked earlier at, as we read chapter 1, at what God asked Hosea to do. It's pretty radical, isn't it? I do like the cartoon that's on your handout. One chap talking to another. She's a lying, cheating whore, but she makes a good metaphor. Don't you think the chap on the right looks a bit like Barry Lamb? You know what I'm saying? Isn't that true? I don't know. I'm just saying. It just looks a bit like that to me. I'm not sure who the fella on the left is. We'll have to work that one out. We'll have a look around the fellowship. Hosea's whole life was a walking, talking visual aid. The straying wife and the children were all visible, constant reminders of the message. Perhaps there's no other prophet in the Bible who had such an intertwining of his message and his life. Imagine this being your assignment as a new disciple. It says in chapter 1 there that God's call to him to marry this woman was when he began to speak, when the Lord began to speak through Hosea in verse 2. So this is early on in his prophetic career. He's not been going a while. So imagine, you get baptized, and 6 months later someone says, we'd like you to lead a family group. That's pretty challenging. Some of us did that. Some of us may do that from the time now. But imagine that someone said, we want you to go and marry someone who's going to become a prostitute. That's your calling from God. And we think leading a family group is a tough call. Hosea's family. Hosea is a problem family. And God compares his situation, his own situation, not to that of an autocrat whose orders no one dares to question, nor of a father who rejoices in an adoring wife and children, but to that of a husband whose wife has left him, and a father whose children are like strangers in his own house and are fast destroying themselves. We need to know that God understands that we live in a difficult world that's wrecked by sin. And he understands that, and he feels what we feel. This book teaches us about the grace of God, the heart of God, and what it means to be a man or woman of God. Now let's move on to talk about Hosea and his times. Let's put some context into Hosea's prophesying, his teaching, and all that is going on. Hosea and his times. First of all, we'll look at the historical, political, and economic situation. You have some maps, but they may be clearer if you look at these. I don't know. Now, the kingdom of Israel. First of all, we had Saul as king, then we have David as king, and then we have his son Solomon as king, and they are a united kingdom. And that you have in the blue on your map, on the screen at least, is the United Kingdom of Israel and Judah. Now, after Solomon, his son Rehoboam comes along. And what kind of leader is he? Is he a benevolent ruler? No. He's the chap who says, "My father, you know, used to whip you a bit. I'm going to use scorpions, right, and whip you with scorpions." This is not a great situation. And so, what happens during Rehoboam's reign? There's a split in the kingdom, right? The 10 tribes go off to the north with Jeroboam, and he forms the northern kingdom. And that's the other map you have there, the divided kingdom. We've got Israel in the north, we've got Judah in the south. Judah is often called Ephraim. In the book of Hosea, when you read Ephraim, that's another word for Israel. It was used often because it was the largest tribe amongst that tribe, the group of 10 tribes. Israel in the north, Judah in the south. At the time of Hosea's prophesying, there was a political threat to the people of Israel in the north, and that was the Assyrian Empire. There's the early Assyrian Empire in the reddish-orange. And you can see the threat reaching down to what it covers Damascus, and is soon going to extend down to the major lands that Israel occupy. Later, after the time of Hosea, this is the later Assyrian Empire, which encompassed all of that area. It was the biggest, most powerful empire of its time. Let's talk about who was around at this time. First of all, Israel. You'll notice at the beginning of Hosea in chapter 1, verse 1, it talks about a few kings being around during Hosea's time. It mentions Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah as kings of Judah, and it mentions Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, as king of Israel. So the kings of Israel and the situation in Israel, what do we have? Well, on the screen and on your handout, I've given you just a little bit of the history of that period from about 860 BC to 720 BC. The situation is that political stability is there. It is politically stable at the time, but this political stability is soon to end. Jeroboam II, who is mentioned and is in the middle of that, in the lower half of the plate there on Israel's kings and so on, he ruled for 40 years. That was a very unusually long time in the north, the longest of all their kings. And so when you have a long reign, things tend to feel stable and you feel safe and comfortable and, you know, everything's going to continue on as it always has. But he wasn't the only king in the north during the time of Hosea's life. It does seem, though, that the other kings weren't mentioned, basically because Jeroboam ruled for so long. If you want background to all these kings, please do read 2 Kings chapter 15 to 17, and that will give you the background of what's going on. Soon after Hosea began to prophesy, Jeroboam II's reign was to end, and with it, Jehu's dynasty, which had lasted almost 100 years. The next six kings were to follow in quick succession and to reign a combined total of only 30 years, an average of 5 years each. And most of those kings were bloodthirsty. Read 2 Kings 15 to 17 for more details on that. But just to give you a short summary of it, after Jeroboam II had reigned for 40 years, he was succeeded by his son Zechariah, who reigned for a year and was assassinated by Shalom. He reigned for a month before being killed by Menahem. And turn with me just for one reference to 2 Kings 15. Keep your finger in Hosea, but let's just have a little look at him. 2 Kings chapter 15. You've got to read 2 Kings. It's just incredible, and it will give you great background for this whole series. It'll also disturb you somewhat, but it's about real life. 2 Kings 15, Menahem. Let's do from verse 13. 2 Kings 15, verse 13. Just to give you a flavor of what's going on. Shalom, son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, king of Judah, and he reigned in Samaria 1 month. Then Menahem, son of Gadi, went from Tirzah up to Samaria. He attacked Shalom, son of Jabesh, in Samaria, assassinated him, and succeeded him as king. The other events of Shalom's reign and the conspiracy he led are written in the book of the Annals of the King and Kings of Israel. At that time, Menahem, starting out from Tirzah, attacked Tifsa and everyone in the city and its vicinity because they refused to open their gates. He sacked Tiphsah and ripped open all the pregnant women. This is meant to be the people of Israel. This is meant to be the people of God. These are not the physical, but the spiritual descendants of David, who wrote those psalms. And it's not that long after. It doesn't take long for God's people to stray if we're not focused right and listening to what God is teaching us. Menahem lasted 10 years. He was succeeded by his son Pekahiah, who lasted 2 years before he was assassinated by Pekah, who reigned for 20 years before being assassinated by Hosea, who was on the throne for 9 years. His was the kingship that saw the final destruction of Israel. Quite an irony when we realize that his name, Hosea, is the same name as Hosea. It's the same name, it's just spelled a bit differently. And it's basically the same name as Joshua and the same name as Jesus. God saves. Or God will rescue. And yet his is the kingship when Israel is finally destroyed. I mean, not just destroyed, annihilated. The people are deported and those 10 tribes never are seen again. Ever. Still to this day. Pretty intense. This is the situation in which Hosea is prophesying. Each turn of the helm brought the ship of state closer to the rocks. His words were addressed to people on a ship that was already beginning to sink. The economic times, well, the prosperity was soon to end. Some people have said it's the best of times, the worst of times. The economy was good. Politically, things were secure. Religion was flourishing. That's the interesting thing. But it was a shallow, fragile, empty version of religion. Within a generation, the kingdom of Israel would be extinct. It was to the last truly free generation that Hosea came to prophesy. His was the last voice of hope. How much God must have been hoping that they would listen. Hosea knew this was their last chance, which is why I believe he was so willing to do something so desperate, as we see in the book of Hosea. Judah, meanwhile, to the south. You have another slide or thing for that? To the south, we have Judah. Of course, at the beginning of the book of Hosea, although Hosea is in the north and preaching to the north, he mentions the kings of the south, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. He mentions them. I've given you a slide of the years from roughly 920 to 580 B.C., which we won't go into right now. Judah is doing a bit better than Israel spiritually, but they're still in great danger. You remember Hezekiah manages to save Jerusalem, but that's all he escapes with. It's a pretty desperate situation. And Judah does fall about 120 to 140 years later than Israel, depending on when you count the dates from different events, which you can study another time. The spiritual situation. Let's go back to the book of Hosea and to chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. What's the spiritual situation like in Israel at this time, in the northern kingdom? Hosea chapter 4, we'll just pick out one verse for now, and we'll study this more in the weeks to come. Chapter 4, verse 15. Though you commit adultery, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Do not go to Gilgal. Do not go up to Beth Aven, and do not swear, as surely as the Lord lives. What's the significance of this? Well, he mentions Gilgal and Beth Aven here. Now, Beth Aven is really Bethel. Bethel means house of God. That was one of these shrines. But Hosea renames it Beth Aven, which means house of evil, rather than house of God. The shrines, Bethel is one of the shrines set up by Jeroboam when he split from Judah. Dan was another one, though that's not mentioned in Hosea. Gilgal is a place that means ring of stones and is about a mile from Jericho, though the location has not been finally nailed down, but it's in that kind of area. Amos, the prophet Amos, actually encouraged Israel to go and worship at these places of evil intent, but he was doing it ironically. Amos chapter 4, verse 4. Let's turn to Hosea chapter 10 as well and look at what else is going on there. Hosea chapter 10, verse 5. Chapter 10, verse 5. The people who live in Samaria fear for the calf idol of Beth Aven. Its people will mourn over it, and so will its idolatrous priests, those who had rejoiced over its splendor because it is taken from them into exile. The priests and the people are more concerned about a calf idol being captured than they are about the fact that Yahweh is not being worshipped and honored appropriately. There are calf idols in this place. And same in chapter 8, so if you could turn to chapter 8, verse 5. Back a page or so. Hosea says in verse 5, "Throw out your calf idol, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of purity? They are from Israel. This calf, a craftsman made it. It is not God. It will be broken in pieces, that calf of Samaria." You get the idea here that what's happening is the people are now worshipping other gods, or at least they're worshipping idols. It may be in Yahweh's name, but nonetheless, we know what happened in Exodus when that happened, and that was not good. What did God want? I mean, idolatry is perhaps Hosea's main theme. The failure of the northern kingdom to worship the God of Israel alone. God's people reject him in three main areas. Hosea 11, let's go there. We're going to be flipping around a little bit today, of course. More detail in the classes to come in the weeks ahead. God's people reject him in three main areas. Firstly, in religion. Chapter 11, verse 2, they worship other gods. "But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals and they burned incense to images." They worship other gods. They reject him in that way. They also reject him in politics because, of course, the nation of Israel is meant to be a theocracy. They're meant to follow God before they even follow their king. In Hosea chapter 7, let's turn there. There's an incredible mixture of shabby intrigues and dubious leaders in the political realm. In chapter 7, verse 1. "Whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed and the crimes of Samaria revealed. They practice deceit. Thieves break into houses. Bandits rob in the streets. But they do not realize that I remember all their evil deeds. Their sins engulf them. They are always before me. They delight the king with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. They are all adulterers, burning like an oven whose fire the baker need not stir from the kneading of the dough till it rises. On the day of the festival of our king, the princes will become inflamed with wine, and he joins hands with the mockers. Their hearts are like an oven. They approach him with intrigue. Their passion smolders all night. In the morning, it blazes like a flaming fire. All of them are hot as an oven. They devour their rulers. All their kings fall, and none of them calls on me." None of them calls on me. They don't see what's going on. Their kings are being murdered in front of them. They don't see what's going on. Chapter 8 as well, verse 4. Just the next page or so. Chapter 8, verse 4. "They set up kings without my consent. They choose princes without my approval." They become secularized in their thinking rather than depending upon God. God's people reject him in religion, in politics, and in morals. Let's go to chapter 4. This is the background of the book. This is what's going on in the culture, in the society, and if you like, in the church, in that context. Chapter 4, verse 2. "There is only cursing, lying and murder, stealing and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed." Chapter 4, verse 13. Verse 13, the same chapter. "They sacrifice on the mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills under oak, poplar, and terebinth where the shade is pleasant. Therefore, your daughters turn to prostitution and your daughters-in-law to adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they turn to prostitution, nor your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery, because the men themselves consort with harlots and sacrifice with shrine prostitutes. A people without understanding will come to ruin." This is not just a bad situation. This is not just not quite as it should be. This is a completely perverted religion that they are now practicing. God's people reject him in religion, in politics, and in morals. The people had plenty of religious activity. But that wasn't what God wanted. He wanted what's on the slide. He wanted people, converted people, deeply repentant, holy, and forever his. That's the spiritual situation. What about a few more things of context? Hosea had some contemporary prophets. He had Isaiah prophesying in the south around this time, a slight overlap. Micah was also prophesying in the south. Jonah was prophesying to Nineveh. And Amos was prophesying to the north, although he was from Tekoa in the south. Interestingly, Amos prophesied a lot about social justice issues about 28 years before the fall of Samaria and the northern kingdom, whereas Hosea's interest seems to be idolatry. Maybe there was a shift, because he's prophesying a little bit later. There might have been a shift in the most significant sins away from social issues to idolatry. I think it does tell us that sins go in waves. They kind of become fashionable. Not that we would think about it that way. But it's not like the same emphasis on sin is always the same in every society or in any group, like a church even. And it makes me wonder sometimes whether we recognize and are thinking about what are the fashionable sins, even in church. It happens. Sometimes it's harshness. And sometimes it's whatever the opposite is. Sentimentality. You understand what I'm saying here? We need to pray that God will make us alert to whatever the fashionable sin is. And listen to the Hosea voice of radicalness to bring us back to what God would have us be. Amen? He had some contemporaries. What was the state of the spiritual leadership, the priesthood? Well, chapter 4, let's go back there. The spiritual leadership was not in good shape. Chapter 4, verse 7. The more the priests increased, the more they sinned against me. They exchanged their glory for something disgraceful. They feed on the sins of my people and relish the wickedness. And it will be like people, like priests, and I will punish both of them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. Chapter 6, verse 9. As marauders lie in ambush for a man, so do bands of priests. They murder on the road to Shechem, committing shameful crimes. We'll look at this more in our classes to come. The priesthood, the spiritual leadership, is not in good shape. And we also see later in the book that there is, or other parts of the book, there's also God has his eye on the far future, which I think is the Messiah, which we haven't got time to go into now. So to summarize what we've looked at here about the state of the situation in Israel at this time, to summarize it, I would say in two areas of religion and politics, the main line that the people were saying, that Hosea was fighting against, was this. In religion, we want to have a bit of everything. We think Yahweh's great. He's awesome. Abraham was cool. Jacob and Joshua, we like all those guys. But that's okay for those, like the praying and that kind of, like, he takes care of us. He'll look after us and he's our God. But he isn't the one that gives us the harvest. He isn't the one that makes it rain. Baal's the guy, right? Baal's the storm god. Baal's the one that guarantees the crops. And that's really important, or else we all die. So Yahweh, you can have your sacrifices, but Baal needs his as well. And we just keep those two things together and everybody will be happy up there and we'll all be happy down here. And there is always a tendency in society and in every religious movement to begin radically, to begin clear, to begin with a clarity of focus and mission and purpose, and then to drift and assimilate the ideas of the world. No movement in history, no Christian group, no church movement is immune from that drift. It is up to us to have the right heart to listen to what God teaches in his word, to be sure that we cut off those things that we accumulate and we come back to the narrow way instead of drifting in our faith. They wanted a bit of everything. Woe to us if we want a bit of everything. Let's stay narrow in the right way. The other thing they wanted was, in politics, don't change anything. Let's keep it all nice and stable. And let's face it, we would sacrifice a lot of things for stability. We like stability. We don't like change, whether it's in politics or in our faith. So these are the main summaries from our introduction, and we'll take a break in a moment. It concludes our first session looking at Hosea and his times. I hope this has been helpful. We're going to take a 10-minute break. come back at 11:05. If you have any questions from the first session, you can please write them down and give them to me, and I'll see if I can answer them. And we'll come back and talk about Hosea the prophet and Hosea the man in 10 minutes' time. Thanks very much.
That concludes this session on Hosea. If you'd like more information about the church, please visit our website, iccmissions.org, or email me, malcolm_cox@icoc.org.